Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Welcome back, everyone, from the 4th of July weekend. Hope you all had a great time. We've got a lot of big news today, so we're going to jump right in and start our show. This is Miriam Raftery with this week's local government report. San Miguel Fire Board will hold a meeting Monday night on CAL FIRE compliance issues. In addition, the board will address concerns over paramedic staffing raised by backcountry blogger Charlene Ayers of the Ranter's Roost. Ayers contends that CAL FIRE has provided inexperienced paramedics after taking over the district's firefighting and emergency medical services. Newly assigned Fire Chief Ray Cheney will also be introduced at this meeting. On Tuesday, El Cajon City Council will hear a report from staff on Prop O, a half-cent increase in sales tax that was approved by voters back in 2004. The measure expires this year, and council must determine whether to try and extend it or allow the tax to drop back to the pre-2004 level. Council will also hold a public hearing on whether to grant a conditional use permit for Marriott Courtyard Hotel to include outdoor dining and drinking. La Mesa City Council on Tuesday will hear an East County demographics study presented by the East County Economic Development Council, as well as a presentation on wastewater reclamation. A staff recommendation to regulate electronic cigarettes will also be heard, as well as a request by council members Ernie Ewan and Christine Alicio, who want the city to hire a public relations and information officer. A hearing on resolution of sewer service charges will also be conducted in La Mesa. San Diego County supervisors meet on Tuesday and Wednesday. On Tuesday, supervisors will consider funding requests from public service agencies. A hearing will be held on conflict of interest codes for public agencies, plus supervisors will issue a response to grand jury reports from the last year. On Wednesday, supervisors will hear an appeal of a Ramona Planning Commission decision that denied a tentative map for Oak Tree Ranch, a proposed condominium project, as well as a hearing on vacating an open space easement in Lakeside's Lake Jennings neighborhood. Collier Park basketball court improvements and the South County Multiple Species Conservation Plan report are also slated to be heard by supervisors in their Wednesday hearing.
This is Leon Thompson with a public service announcement from the California Transportation Department, or Caltrans. Caltrans highway workers will be working at the connector ramp from westbound Interstate 8 to northbound Interstate 5 for 2 weeks starting Monday, July 7th. The work will be done both days and nights. The connector ramp will close nightly starting Tuesday, July 8th until February, July 18th. Crews will close some northbound I-5 lanes from I-8 to just north of SeaWorld Drive on July 8th through July 11th for restriping, and again on July 14th through 15th to place temporary K-rail barriers on the left shoulder. Daytime work will take place behind the barriers, leaving the freeway lanes open during commuter hours. Warning, with the temporary restriping, the painted lines will no longer match the cut seams in pavement. Motorists are advised that the lanes will look different and they should follow the striping. The work is part of the $24 million I-5 to I-8 connector project. The project will add a lane on the westbound I-5 at the connecting ramp to southbound I-5. It will also add two lanes on I-5 from the I-8 interchange north to SeaWorld Drive. This major project is scheduled to be completed in the summer of 2016.
Controversy over the wave of immigrants coming here from Central America, mostly families and children fleeing violence there, continues to heat up. Though the tide is turning, with a growing number of community members speaking out in support of the immigrants. Last week, anti-immigration protesters blocked a busload of immigrants in Murrieta, some shouting racial slurs. The protesters forced officials to take migrants to San Ysidro instead. And then, on July 2nd, at a community meeting in Murrieta, over 1,000 people turned out. Inside, the speakers railed against the government for announcing that more immigrants would be brought to Murrieta to ease crowding in Texas facilities.
Is an invasion. Why is the National Guard not out there stopping them from coming in?
Not welcome in Murrieta. It's not welcome in our community.
But outside, a much larger crowd turned out in support of the immigrants.
They didn't let us speak in there.
At a subsequent rally in Murrieta, officials arrested 5 protesters for being disruptive. But elsewhere in California, the immigrants have received a far warmer welcome. In El Centro, San Diego Congressman Juan Vargas met personally with immigrant children sent there, bringing a Bible and praying with migrant families. Congressman Vargas talked with East County Magazine news partner 10 News afterwards.
These are kids. A lot of them are 9, 10, 6, 5. You know, one of them was a 1-year-old. And these kids, interesting, they seem to be more afraid of the angry mob in Murrieta than the murderers down in Honduras. There's something wrong here.
The congressman said U.S. Border Patrol agents are treating the children with compassion locally, some bringing diapers and toys for the youngsters. In San Diego, meanwhile, a coalition of groups that includes border angels and local churches has banded together to help the migrant families arriving in our country. Here is what Enrique Morones, founder of the Border Angels, had to say at a rally supporting the immigrants late last week.
I don't know if you know it, but we're planning to have a forum. With your permission, I'm actually talking to people at USD on this issue in the next 10 days or so. One of the things that's very important is President Obama said this is a humanitarian crisis. It is, and it deserves humanitarian response. Saying send them back is not humanitarian. These kids will die. These family members will die. One of the things that we would like to consider, and we're going to be talking to our elected officials and the consulates, is having the United States have a stronger presence with NGOs and the embassies in these countries. So if I'm in threat of dying, I can go to that embassy in Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and tell them my case and hopefully get a visa. So I don't have to take that 1,000-mile journey up north. So that's one of the things that we're looking at. These children will be held for 72 hours if they're from Central America. That was a law that was passed under the Bush administration. And then they're going to be looking for a family member so they can send them to that family member here in the U.S. Or this is where you all come in. Or a place where they can stay. I know that the Max Charter School has said, hey, listen, we got a big place. We would like them to stay. I know a lot of the churches have said, hey, you know, they can stay with us. So we're sorting out those details, and we're working with the authorities. I spoke with Border Patrol Chief Paul Beeson yesterday, and he said it's great that you're collecting things, that you're collecting clothes and food and water, because they're going to be needing this. So we're doing a call out, and we're also telling them, call us. We'll go pick up those people. We want to welcome these people with love, and we want to stand on the side of love.
He then introduced a local religious leader who called for compassion for the children and their families.
Standing on the side of love are our Unitarian friends. I'm going to ask Reverend Dr. Beth Johnson to say a few words. And she's from Palomar Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Reverend?
Thank you so much. Again, I'm Beth Johnson. I'm also on the board of URISE, Unitarian Universalist Refugee and Immigrant Services and Education, and the president of the board of Interfaith Center for Worker Justice. Human beings have within each of us the capacity for great empathy and compassion, and the capacity for fear, separateness, and hate. Our religious traditions all teach us to nurture love, to nurture compassion, to open ourselves to God's message of each and every person being created in the image of a loving God, a God of justice and a God of compassion. When we treat children as objects of disdain and level hatred, abuse, and assault on them, we are committing acts against the holy. Each and every person is holy. Each and every person has inherent worth and dignity.
She denounced the hatred that has been shown by some toward the children, and then she said,
if we are able to see the humanity in one another, we will then be able to respond with kindness, with compassion, with reason. All of the traditions ask that we treat others as we would want to be treated. If we are afraid or lonely or lost, what would we want people to do to us and our children? These children are all of our children. We are not separate. We are all their mothers and fathers, siblings, aunts and uncles. We are all caught in an inescapable garment of destiny, as Dr. King said. What happens to one happens to all. So let us be the people. Let us be the people that reach out in love and that stand on the side of love. and act in accordance with what all of our faith and humanist traditions call us to treat others with dignity and respect. Thank you.
Thank you.
East County Magazine reporter Nadine Abbott was at that rally on July 1st, where she spoke with Professor Everard Mead, director of the Transborder Institute at the University of San Diego. He provided the history and the backdrop behind what has led to this influx in immigrant children and their families.
So, Professor, the conditions in Central America that we're seeing that are becoming a crisis actually have become a crisis.
Yes.
Can they be tied to several events, Iran-Contra and CAFTA?
Yes, but I would say that it's even bigger. You know, you could tie them to, there's a very clear connection between U.S. intervention in the region generally during the second half of the Cold War. So it's bigger than any one particular policy. So the U.S. supported military dictatorships in all three of the countries that are sending the kids. And it's important to note, too, it's just those three countries, right? Kids aren't coming from Nicaragua or Panama or even Caribbean countries, right? These kids are coming Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, right? Places where the U.S. had a very intensive intervention, particularly in the 1980s, but it actually began before that. Okay, so if you take the next step forward then, what happens? Well, during the height of the crisis, we also denied refugee status to people from those countries. So a huge portion of the Central American population in the United States are people who asked for refugee status during the wars and didn't get it. Some stayed as undocumented, some were deported, and others over the course of the 1990s got temporary protected status, which is a kind of non-deportation, but that's it. It doesn't necessarily give work authorization. It's very tenuous, right? So they got extended a couple of times during the 1990s, but we largely forgot Central America. Our foreign policy just disappeared on Central America for most of the 1990s. And what happened, what filled that void, was really acute social conditions. Things got worse. Poverty and inequality got worse. The murder rate actually got worse than during the height of the civil wars. Kidnapping, organized crime, things that hadn't really had a presence in Central America got worse. The drug trade moved to Central America. It's gotten a lot more intense as the Mexican drug war has kind of moved south. But yeah, so these are all things where there's a piece of an American policy question. And then after 2011, and more recently, I think it's really important to note, because people aren't talking about this, the U.S. has been deeply involved in migration policy throughout the region. And we've helped to fund and train border enforcement throughout the region. And it obviously hasn't worked. In fact, a lot of the worst human rights violations that are committed against kids on the journey through Central America and through Mexico to get here, many of them are either committed by law enforcement in those countries or by people operating with their tacit support or who've paid them off. So solutions that focus just on enforcement throughout the region aren't likely to work. Why? Because we've been doing them for 10 years and really for more than a generation and they haven't worked. So yeah, and then CAFTA, the free trade part, is another piece of it. That's part of the bigger world economy situation in which Central America has a very particular relationship with the United States. But I would say even more important than that, it's the legacy of migration and the importance of remittances to the Central American economies. It averages somewhere between 17 and 20% of the economy of all those countries are remittances sent back from the U.S. In other words, the relationships between these countries are not something that can be changed with the stroke of a pen in immigration law, either a really permissive immigration law or a really restrictive one. This relationship and the fact that people are going to move back and forth as part of it, it's here to stay. And it's here until there's a major socioeconomic readjustment in Central America. So the question that we've got is, do we want to deal with this kind of crisis to crisis on an ad hoc basis, or do we want to deal with this in some kind of orderly, principled, and humanitarian fashion where we think about the long term?
Another question, and this has to do specifically with Guatemala, because I'm familiar with that. We also have problems with native communities like the Maya that were targeted during the Luis Mott administration and before.
Right.
And have led to a lot of basically fleeing for their lives for ethnic reasons and genocide.
Yes. Yes, no, it's very true. That population hasn't gotten a lot of attention. There have been a couple of stories about it recently. And it's difficult because in their claims, when they've been interviewed, for example, by the UN High Commission for Refugees, Guatemala, about half of the kids coming from Guatemala are indigenous. those kids, and what they've told so far in interviews, they're fleeing abysmal poverty as much as, you know, gang violence and things we hear more from urban Central America. So that doesn't mean that they're not facing violence, because the reason that those communities are in extreme poverty, the reason that they've been abandoned, the reason that a lot of them don't have parents or guardians with them goes back to, yes, the Rios Montt administration, the genocide in Guatemala, and the whole set of social issues around land tenure in indigenous Central America. So yeah, it's a bigger question, but it's not, again, it's not as simply a one-to-one. It's not, you know, one intervention or one decision that was made. It's a whole matrix of them over a long period of time.
While some maintain protests against the Central American migrants, voicing concerns over how America can absorb so many newcomers, support for the young immigrants continues to grow. On Sunday, July 6th, 10 members of the San Diego Symphony and the Baja Orchestra performed a concert at Friendship Park in San Ysidro to show love for the children. Donations from diapers to clothing are pouring into the Border Angels office, where Morones says that next up, he will be launching a teddy bear drive to help the frightened children. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Keeping and creating new jobs in the aerospace industry is the goal of a bill passed by the State Assembly on Thursday. Calling California the historic home of the aerospace industry, Assemblyman Steve Fox says his bill will create 1,100 new jobs and nearly 5,000 jobs in supporting fields. Fox says AB 2389 provides tax credits so California companies can compete on an even playing field with their competition.
They're going to be able to take this tax credit and put it as part of their application. They're going to be able to go get the jobs now. They're going to win the contracts. They're going to bring the bacon home.
The legislation that came together in just 6 weeks is crucial because California aerospace companies are currently bidding on federal Department of Defense projects with bids due next month. Assemblyman Fox says this tax credit will employ people in his district in the Antelope Valley, as well as statewide, in good, high-paying jobs. He says, in turn, employers and employees will support local businesses and create more jobs.
There's hundreds of aerospace companies all over the state. If one of our companies happens to get one of the contracts, it's going to bring jobs. The housing market's going to go up. But people are going to be able to feed their families. This is a great boon to the state.
Fox says the tax credit will also help keep our men and women serving in the armed forces supplied with the most high-tech equipment available when they're deployed in active combat zones. The bill offers up to $420 million in tax breaks over 15 years for the aerospace industry. AB 2389 now heads to the state Senate. For Public News Service, I'm Lori Abbott.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This is Janice Russell, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting the People Power segment today. Firefighters held the banner fire to 217 acres before they finally fully contained the blaze that destroyed two homes. For Julian residents, the fire brought some tense moments. Rosemary Keene watched as the blaze encroached close to her new home still under construction in Julian Estates. Her home was spared, but John Rafe Snyder was not so fortunate. His home and the forest he loved around it were destroyed by the flames while he watched and videotaped the devastation on his iPad. The fire was so intense that not even the 200 feet of defensible space that he had just cleared around his home could save it. Then on July 4th, a rainstorm swept across our mountains as several relieved residents posted on the Julian Connection site on Facebook. "Who did the rain dance?" one resident asked. Others posted messages of gratitude. "Thank God for our brave firemen. They saved Whispering Pines and Kentwood yesterday," another resident wrote, while still others gleefully said that they were dancing in the rain. The online community forum is proving to be a valuable resource to Julian residents eager for information during the fires. Absentee residents got updates this time from those remaining in the area and learned that at least one resident reportedly stayed in Kentwood despite the evacuations. Marty Emery reported that Gavin Jones fought a spur of the fire threatening his home and Emery's, risking his safety to help save his house and others. "He lost a few trees and his whole property is orange from the airdrop flame retardant," Emery's post reads. The community is also pulling together to help those in need. A donation jug was set up during the fire at Granny's Kitchen Restaurant to help Mr. Rafe Snyder, who lost his home. CAL FIRE and the California Highway Patrol announced cancellation of the Julian 4th of July parade due to the need to keep roads open for firefighting equipment and, if needed, more evacuations. This news came as disappointment to Julian residents. But fortunately, with help from Mother Nature, firefighters gained control over the Banner Fire and all evacuation orders have been lifted. Patriotic members of the American Legion, however, marched anyway in what they called an Independence Day Freedom Walk, proudly carrying the donation jug for fire survivor John Rafe Snyder down the main street of Julian, as once again, East County's rural residents pulled together to help one of their own in need.
This is Raina Menashe reporting for East County Magazine. My Life, a social media website, recently did an analysis of data to determine the most patriotic cities in the U.S. The results are in, just in time for the 4th of July, and San Diego is ranked number one. My Life's analysis included four sets of data: the percentage of population in the armed forces, total spending on veterans, popularity of fireworks in July, and community and social service workers. The cities that ranked very well in total spending on veterans were important in determining which cities made the top 10 rankings. San Diego ranked 5th in veteran spendings and 1st in overall patriotic spirit. Some states had multiple cities earning top rankings for this analysis. Texas had 5 cities and California had 2. You can read the full analysis at www.mylife.com or at eastcountymagazine.org.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with today's Capitol Report. The Supreme Court decision last week in the Hobby Lobby case is drawing strong reactions across the nation and here in San Diego County, also raising questions over whether the Supreme Court lacks adequate religious diversity. By a 5-4 vote, the justices extended rights to family-held corporations formerly reserved only for individuals, churches, and religious nonprofits. The court's majority struck down a key provision of Obamacare, ruling that small family-held corporations do not have to provide their employees with coverage for forms of birth control that conflict with the owner's religious beliefs. Hobby Lobby is a craft supply store chain owned by evangelical Christians, while Conestoga Wood Specialties, the other plaintiff in the case, is a Pennsylvania cabinet-making company owned by Mennonites. The decision means that workers lose the right to insurance coverage for certain forms of birth control, such as IUDs, if they work for a family-owned company that objects on religious grounds. It also means that rape victims at such companies would not be able to buy the morning-after pill unless they can afford to pay for it themselves. Reverend Barry Lynn, executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, called the decision a dangerous precedent. But Archbishop Joseph Kurtz, leader of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, hailed the ruling as a great day for religious freedom for family businesses. All 5 justices who voted in the majority had 2 things in common. They are all men, and they are all Catholic. The 4 justices who voted against the ruling included all 3 of the High Court's women, as well as Justice Stephen Breyer. Justice Samuel Alito, in the majority opinion, claims that the Obama administration health care rules in effect told plaintiffs that their religious views were flawed. But Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in a blistering dissent, writes that the case is not about the plausibility of a religious claim. Instead, she says, it is about whether accommodating that claim risks depriving others of rights accorded to them under the laws of the United States. California's Attorney General Kamala Harris issued a statement along with 13 other state attorney generals criticizing the decision. She stated that the decision opens a perilous loophole that may enable private, for-profit companies to challenge other common-sense laws, including those that protect against discrimination based on the religious beliefs of their shareholders. Just how far could this ruling extend? There are religions that don't believe in blood transfusion or surgeries. Could such employers refuse to provide coverage for these life-saving procedures? What if a company is owned by a devout Muslim or Orthodox Jew who believes pork is unclean? Could they deny a heart patient coverage for implanting a heart valve from a pig? Could other laws besides health care that currently protect workers be at risk too if an employer claims a religious exemption? The ruling does restrict religious exemptions to family-run businesses where five or fewer people control 50% or more of the company. It's not all companies. But that leaves a lot of corporations that can now claim religious freedoms for the first time ever in our nation's history. In the past, religious exemptions to laws were allowed only for individual people, churches, and religious nonprofits such as church-run schools. Locally, some elected officials are speaking out on this latest extension of corporate rights by the Supreme Court. Democratic Congressman Scott Peters calls the decision outrageous, given the large percentage of women who use birth control pills to treat serious ailments from endometriosis to post-chemotherapy hormone replacement. He adds that it is in everyone's interest for women to have access to affordable, safe, preventative care. Speaker of the House Toni Atkins, a San Diego Democrat and the top woman leader in the state legislature, said the Supreme Court sacrificed justice and freedom by ruling that private business owners could impose their religious beliefs on their employees and deny women their constitutionally recognized right to comprehensive reproductive health care. She believes the decision goes against Americans' belief in the right of everyone to be treated fairly and equally in the workplace. San Diego's Republican leaders have thus far been silent publicly on the Hobby Lobby ruling, but at the national level, prominent Republicans have lined up in support of the decision. The top Republican in Congress, House Speaker John Boehner, hailed the High Court's ruling as a win for religious freedom, a victory against big government, and what he views as a crossing of constitutional lines by the administration. The decision casts a spotlight on the conservative makeup of this court. The ruling comes on the heels of another recent case that gave broader rights to protesters outside abortion clinics. The court's liberal justices are aging. Thus, the next president is expected to make one or more key appointments that will tip the balance of power in the nation's highest court. If Republicans win the White House in the next election, and a new president appoints just one more conservative justice, the landmark Roe v. Wade decision is expected to be overturned, making abortion illegal again. Roe v. Wade gave women the right to abortion in the third trimester for any reason. In the second trimester, if a physician approves, such as where amniocentesis shows a serious birth defect, and in the third trimester, only in dire circumstances, such as if a mother's life is at risk. Democrats say the High Court's recent ruling in Hobby Lobby reflects a war on women waged by Republican lawmakers who have introduced bills in states across the nation and in Congress that would drastically restrict rights that women's groups fought hard to win. For example, Congressman Duncan Hunter, a Republican who represents San Diego and much of East County, introduced a bill shortly after his election that would have outlawed all abortions with no exceptions nationwide, not even for women whose lives were in danger, nor for rape victims or even children who became pregnant through incest. The balance of power in the Senate could also determine who will win appointment to the Supreme Court when future openings occur, since the Senate must confirm whoever the president appoints. With five Catholic male justices making this ruling that impacts women workers of all faiths, many Americans are asking whether greater diversity of religious views may be in order. America has people practicing many religions, yet the court's majority are from a single church, and their recent decisions have fallen in line with that church's point of view. Besides Christianity, the Jewish faith is the only other religion currently reflected among the High Court's nine justices. Might this decision have been different if the court had members who were Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, atheist, agnostic, or who belonged to progressive Christian churches? The current court justices, interestingly, have not been even-handed in doling out protections based on religious freedoms. For example, Justice Anthony Scalia issued a decision in the early 1990s that denied Native Americans freedom of religion to use peyote, a plant used for centuries in their ceremonies. Peyote is a controlled substance in the United States. One fact emerges clearly from the Hobby Lobby decision. The case has galvanized believers on both sides of this controversial issue to rally their political forces in hopes of claiming political victories in the 2016 Senate and presidential races, elections that will likely determine the balance of power in the Supreme Court and have an impact across America that will last long into the future. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Leon Thompson with a public service announcement from the California Transportation Department, or Caltrans. Caltrans highway workers will be working at the connector ramp from westbound Interstate 8 to northbound Interstate 5 for 2 weeks starting Monday, July 7th. The work will be done both days and nights. The connector ramp will close nightly starting Tuesday, July 8th until February, July 18th. Crews will close some northbound I-5 lanes from I-8 to just north of SeaWorld Drive on July 8th through July 11th for restriping, and again on July 14th through 15th to place temporary K-rail barriers on the left shoulder. Daytime work will take place behind the barriers, leaving the freeway lanes open during commuter hours. Warning, with the temporary restriping, the painted lines will no longer match the cut seams in pavement. Motorists are advised that the lanes will look different and they should follow the striping. The work is part of the $24 million I-5 to I-8 connector project. The project will add a lane on the westbound I-5 at the connecting ramp to southbound I-5. It will also add two lanes on I-5 from the I-8 interchange north to SeaWorld Drive. This major project is scheduled to be completed in the summer of 2016.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
The Sequan Tribe has received an Emmy Award for its documentary film chronicling the history of the Kumeyaay people and the Sequan Tribe. So we thought today would be a good opportunity to replay our interview with Sequan Chairman Daniel Tucker, originally recorded at the premiere of that film.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. I'm here today at Sequan with Daniel Tucker, the chairman of the Sequan Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. Today they are debuting a brand new documentary film called Our People, Our Culture, Our History, and it's about the history of the Sequan Band and the Kumeyaay Nation. Chairman Tucker, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. We're really excited about that.
Tell us about the film. What made you decide to make this documentary?
You know, if you would go downtown today or anywhere in the United States, let's say in San Diego, mm-hmm. and you ask the average person out there, do you know what Sequan is? And can you explain to me what an Indian tribe is? And they'll say, yeah. They talk about the Plains Indians. They don't talk about the Indians from California. Because they talk about teepees and those kind of things. That's what it always seems
in
schools and all that kind of stuff. But we lived in huts here in San Diego County because of the climate. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have to dress like they did back in the Plains Indians. What happened with us is that since the climate was so well, we used to make our huts out of willow branches. And that's how we lived. That's how we made our villages. And we want people to know who we really are. We're not Plains Indians. We're Indians from California. And we call ourselves Natives now, but Native Americans. Which is even
right, the original Native Californians.
Exactly. So what's so exciting about this whole documentary, it tells the history of the Kumeyaay people
now,
here in San Diego County.
And does it include the Kumeyaay in what's now Mexico?
Yes,
well,
it does. What was unfortunate, when they put up the border, a lot of our tribes who were Kumeyaay tribes still are still there. And sometimes it's pretty difficult to go see them because we have to go across the border, have to do this. We take them stuff like clothes or anything we can. We have to go through a lot of bureaucracy to do that. Mm-hmm. But they're still doing fine down there. But they are our brothers and sisters, which is pretty interesting. When we decided to do this documentary, we didn't want it to be a story, per se. We want to tell the real history, what happened to the Native Americans in San Diego County in California, what was the life like, how did we live, what did we eat, where we lived. In the summertime, we lived in the mountains. In the wintertime, we lived down by the ocean, because that's where food is plenty. We lived a lot along the Sweetwater River right there, because that's where all the water was, fresh water, and the San Diego River as well. Mm-hmm. One of our biggest villages was right below Presidio Park, where the Great Wall Old Town is.
Yes.
And that was to be a huge Native village at the time. Then, unfortunately, when the big migration came from the east, we ended up with 1 square mile of land out of all the land here in California. And even in San Diego County, we got 1 square mile.
Such a tragedy.
640 acres. And if you ever come out here and see Sequan, the Ridge Reservation, you see half of it's a mountain. Mm-hmm. So we had very little land to work with. But we survived. We survived what we did, and we started to, go with the way of life as it was at the time. When they opened up the first school in Dehesa Valley, that school is over 130 years old, and our people went there. And it was really strange to them, because they weren't allowed to speak our language. They had to speak the white man's language, and they had to deal with that.
Adopt the dress and the customs of the white man.
Adopt the dress and customs, the whole bit. And it was a scary time for us. It was really a time where, wow, what's going to happen with us?
It was really a sense of cultural genocide, in a sense, wasn't it?
Totally in California. Not just in San Diego County, but all the way up along the coast. The first governor of California, I forgot his name, his biggest comment was, a good Indian is a dead Indian.
Wow.
And that was unfortunate. But I don't know if you ever heard his story about Ishii.
Yes.
He's
the last Indian of his particular tribe.
That's right, up in the Sacramento area. And Mrs. Hurst took him in. And somebody knew his language, and they finally got to talk to him a little bit. But it was a genocidal thing. But we persevered. We just, we hung in there. We had to do what we had to do to survive. And we did. And what's happening today, doing this documentary, we want the people of San Diego and this country to know who we really are as a people. We've been here for 12,000 years. And how we lived, where we went to pick our acorns, our harvest time. We do All Souls Day. Mm-hmm. And our traditions and culture have, and since we started doing this, the gaming hole situation, and I have to explain this, is very, very important. People think of Indian tribes today as casino-owned. Casinos are a part of our business. We are a government first. No ifs and buts about it. We are a government. And we have to treat our people as we would like to be treated. And we want to be fair. We want to be sure that our government is running like it should be. So at the time, they didn't call us chiefs. They called us captains during those days. And the captain had all the responsibility to making sure their tribe ate. There was enough food for everyone. If somebody shot a deer, all the families got to eat.
So the casino is, in a sense, a modern-day means of bringing prosperity to the Native American people. And it's certainly not the only business venture that Sequan has. Tell us a little bit about, for people who don't know, some of the other things you're doing today and some of the things you've done for the community, the broader community as well.
Yeah, this is exciting to me, being part of this. I was chairman when we did Prop 5 and Prop 1A. And that was to have legalized gaming in California. Mm-hmm. The Indians of California changed the Constitution of California, enabling us to do what we have today. And so we have our casino, but what's bigger than that, we're allowed to diversify. And that we're doing. We bought the U.S. Grant Hotel, 4th and Broadway downtown. We own the land under the Solomar Hotel, downtown San Diego. We have a business called Marina Gateway, down in National City. And we also have the golf course. The old Singing Hills Golf Course is now Sequan Resort.
That's right.
So we just put those acres, 1,400, matter of fact, into trust status to make it a part of our reservation as of today. And we built new homes for our people. And right now we're doing the whole infrastructure, new water lines. All our telephone wires are going to go underground, the gas, the whole bit. And we're doing that on our own. We're not asking anything from the state. All we ask them to do is let us do what we need to do to make ourselves survive. Because there's laws out there we have to find, environmental, all that stuff,
sure,
we still have to follow.
Speaking of environmental, last year you put on a conference down at the Grant Hotel, mm-hmm, about the impacts of some of the big energy and mining projects on indigenous people, including the Kumeyaay in Mexico. Is that touched on at all in the documentary?
Not that part, just a little bit. You know, we do have people on the other side of the border, but mm-hmm. not that much. It's mostly about the Sequan and the Kumeyaay people of San Diego County. Mm-hmm. And people don't realize San Diego County has more tribes than any state in the continental United States.
Yes.
There are 18 tribes in San Diego County, and most of them are Kumeyaay. And if you need to understand, as our name says, we are the Sequan band of the Kumeyaay Nation. The word band is very important, because band is, we're a band, Hamul's a band, Viejas is a band, Campo, Manzanita, all those tribes out there who are bands of the Kumeyaay Nation.
Right.
So we have our own government on each individual reservation.
Now, in recent times, Sequan has been very good neighbors to the broader community. The Sequan yeah. band has given back quite a bit. Would you like to tell our listeners
about that? Yes, I think
that
is extremely important to this tribe, because what we have here is a situation where we live in San Diego. We're part of San Diego. We're part of our community. And we've always been taught by our elders, always give something to somebody. And in this case, we're giving back to San Diego County. Like this past weekend, I didn't run. I walked for the Susan Komen Breast Cancer Walk.
Okay, good.
And we give $30,000 for that to be part of the sponsorship for that, because it's very important to us. We gave to Radish Children's Hospital, the Diabetes Association, all the things that people really are involved in off
yes,
the reservation.
Fire protection.
Fire protection, a whole bit. In fact, our fire department covers all of Dehesa Valley. And it's just, most of the people here appreciate it. There are some who still
sure.
have some issues, yeah. but mm-hmm. still, we're doing the right thing. We are giving back to our community, and we think that's important. Because San Diego comes to play here. Mm-hmm. They come and enjoy what we have here at Sequan, whether it be the casino, the hotel, the resort, mm-hmm. or anything that we have. People seem to go there more often because, one, they know we give them back to California, San
yes.
Diego. When I was bowling, all the people used to come to me, we play at Sequan because we know you give back to the community. And that just makes you feel good. People do notice those things.
Yes, that's very important.
And what this documentary is telling you is that we are that kind of people, the people who are going to give back, the people who give.
Excellent.
I'll tell you, this is important. We invite people out to the reservation. Are they come and visit us? The first thing we ask them, are you hungry?
Mm-hmm.
And we take them in to feed them. During some of the people coming across the border, and sometimes illegally, that's okay, but those people are hungry too.
Sure.
So we fed them. We fed them and nourished them and gave them water and those kind of things, because we don't want nobody to starve or nobody to be hurt. So we opened them with open arms. San Diego has been a great part of that, us being able to do those things.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's gone into the making of this documentary? How big a project was this?
A lot. It was huge. It's been working this over a year. And one of our tribal members named Cody Martinez, he's actually he took the lead on this thing. Because I can't do everything, Mr. Chairman, because I have so much sort of stuff to deal with. And he took this and embraced it and did a tremendous job with it. Did a tremendous job. He got to all our elders. He's gotten to Ms. Florence Shipek when she was alive. She was an anthropologist in this area and really did a whole study of the Kumeyaay people. The Museum of Man, we used them. And we use all the high-ranking anthropologists and historians in San Diego who really had a part in making of this film.
I know that it's a Kumeyaay tradition to think seven generations ahead. If you look seven generations ahead, Chairman,
we look
what do you want?
Seven generations.
What do you want to see for the future for the Sequan Band and the Kumeyaay Nation?
I see this tribe still being what it is, never forgetting who we are, where we are, and where we came from. But they have to protect our sovereign right as a government and a nation in the United States, because that's important. Because without that sovereignty issue, we're just like everybody else. But because we do have that sovereign status, we are a government, and we use it as that, and we be fair, we work with our people, as the people are our bosses. So when you're elected, you better do the right thing for our people, not just for one individual. It has to be for everybody.
We would all be better off if every elected official had that attitude.
Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great?
Yes. Thank you very, very much. Is there any final words that you have for us?
I'd like to say just come out to Sequan, and maybe you see the casino, that's fine. But look at the land itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I got to tell my daughter, her name is Charlene, she says, The land don't belong to us. We belong to the land. That quote just stuck with me until this day, and it's just the truth. We are protectors of the land, and we do that.
Very good. And listeners can visit the Sequan website. It's sequan.com. And view the documentary online also. I understand our people, our culture, our history, the history of the Sequan Band and the Kumeyaay Nation.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Chairman.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Simonetta Carr, award-winning author of Christian biography series for young readers, published by Reformation Heritage Books. My guest has also written an historical novel on Olympia Morata, as well as articles for newspapers and magazines around the world. A native Italian, she's instructor, translator, and the author of the Italian section of How to Pronounce French, German, and Italian Wine Names, with Luminosa Publishing in San Diego. Welcome, Simonetta. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
Let's begin with your latest book, Anselm of Canterbury. It won the Best Biography in the 2014 San Diego Book Awards. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And first prize at the 2014 Athanatos Christian Book Awards. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy calls this man the outstanding Christian philosopher and theologian of the 11th century. That's a quote. What made you choose to write about him in particular, and why for children?
Well, going back to 2008, when I started this Christian biographies for young readers, the whole idea behind it was I wanted to produce a series that was similar to good quality and factual biographies that you find in bookstores, normally about artists, musicians, mm-hmm. presidents. But I wanted to do something about the development of Christian thought and to help my children and other children to understand what they believed and mm-hmm. why. So Anselm fits very well in this context. He's mostly remembered for a book he wrote, which is entitled Cur Deus Homo. It means Why the God-Man. So, for example, at Christmas, we talk or sing about God becoming man, a mm-hmm. baby in a manger. And I don't know how many people really stop and think why, if God wanted to save mankind, why did he have to do it that way? And Anselm answered that question. Mm-hmm. Before him, there were other answers. They were not as thorough, and they were not as consistent with the biblical message. His answer became the foundation for most Christian historical creeds and confessions. So it's very important what he said to understand one of the most basic tenets of the Christian faith. And I think it's an interesting question for children. I don't know if they've ever wondered, but maybe they will.
And what year did he live in?
Anselm lived in the 11th century.
Is it difficult to do the research on something that happened so long ago?
I don't think it was difficult. It was very interesting. It took a long time because I didn't know anything about that time period. I knew more about maybe the Renaissance, mm-hmm. Less about this time period, but it was fascinating.
I bet. I know the illustrations in the book, they're very realistic and they're really beautiful. What's it like working with illustrators? I know that you have more than one. Mm-hmm. Your principal illustrator is Matt Abraxas. Do you discuss and plan the art ahead of time? How do you decide what to show? And how do you choose the details of such a long ago period?
Well, Matt Abraxas is my main illustrator, and he is an incredible artist, but is also very easy to work with.
That's a good thing.
Yes. So what happens, I write the manuscript, and I also write about 12 illustrations, write the suggestions of what 12 illustrations could be. And he makes two sketches for each illustration, two different views of the same scene. Mm-hmm. And then we discuss it and we share our ideas which one would be mm-hmm. best. And then once that's decided, then we do the research pretty much together. He does a lot of research, and then sometimes he sends me an email and mm-hmm. says, I can't really figure this out. And if neither of us can figure it out, I normally have at least two experts that I consult for each okay. book. And so I bounce the idea back to them. And
these are actual paintings, are they not?
These are actual oil paintings.
Oil paintings.
Yes, yes.
That's why they're so realistic.
Yes.
Well, I know that, as you mentioned, that this is geared towards a specific population, Christian young readers. Do you also hope to reach a broader audience, or is this really targeted to this?
Actually, I am writing with a broader audience in mind. Mm-hmm. So I try to be very factual and as impartial as one can be. For example, this particular book can give an idea of a phase in the development of relationship between church and state, mm. which is very important.
Yes.
And in Europe, actually, children study this time period and these issues because it's part of European history. But I think it has a great impact on mm-hmm. American history. So
what are some of the other biographies in the series?
Okay,
can you tell us some of the names?
Yes. So it's John Calvin, Augustine, John Owen, John Knox, Lady Jane Grey.
Oh, that's a famous one.
That's a famous one. Yeah, and Athanasius.
And what about your historical novel? You say that it's about an interesting character from the Italian Reformation. Mm-hmm. How is that book different from your biographies, and which do you enjoy more?
Yeah, that book, it's actually entitled Weight of a Flame.
Weight of a Flame.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's about Olympia Morata. She was an Italian Protestant humanist, and she was a child prodigy of her day. Mm. So it's an interesting story. It's written more for young adults.
Okay.
But it covers her life pretty much from maybe 16 years of age till she died, which was very young. Olympia died just before her 30th birthday. When I had to write that story, being a historical fiction, I had to imagine a lot of things to fill in the gaps, which I don't do with these books. In these books, in the Christian biographies, the only time we use imaginations is in the illustrations, because
right.
we have to imagine how the scene
right.
looked. But in a historical novel, I had to fill a lot of other gaps. And I don't feel too comfortable with that.
Okay.
So that's why I wrote only one.
Okay. But you also write, I mean, how does this fit in with your writing about wine? Do you yeah. enjoy that part of your writing career?
Well, that was just a friend of mine asked me to do the Italian section of that book. So that had more to do with my training as an Italian instructor.
Right.
So I had to write the pronunciation. But yes, wine is a very enjoyable
and
part.
And do we have a rich wine background history product in San Diego? How are we doing in that area?
Oh, I think California wine is very good.
Oh,
yeah.
Yay. That's good
yes.
to hear. One last question. What's the next thing that you're writing? Is it the next biography or your next project in general?
So I just turned in one manuscript, which would be published in October, and it's Jonathan Edwards. And then I'm already writing for another book for next year, which is Marie Durand. She's a French, yeah,
mm-hmm.
French Protestant. And it's a very interesting story to the time in the 18th century France, so totally different time period. And I've also started something a little different for Chicago Press. I'm writing a biography on Michelangelo of all
that's
people.
Interesting.
Yes.
Yes. Great. Well, thank you so much. Our time is up, but I really appreciate your joining us.
Thank you so much.
If you would like more information on Simonetta Carr and her work, please visit her website at www.cbfyr.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Hi, my name's Dan D'Souza with the County of San Diego's Department of Animal Services. Summertime is here. This is about the only time you'd ever want to see a dog in a car is with someone standing here right beside it with the air conditioning blowing nice cold air on her. Huh, Florence? Huh. So an hour ago, I took a thermometer, put it in the car in the sun in the parking lot here. It was 80 degrees when I left the thermometer in there. An hour later, it was up to 100 degrees. 100 degrees to a dog could be fatal, especially when you have a brachiocephalic dog like Florence, any bulldogs, pugs, things like that. They can't breathe as well in this hot air. Leaving a dog in a car, if it's posing a risk to the animal's health and safety, is against the law. Animal control officers, law enforcement officers have the authority under law to break into your car to rescue your animal. On average, Animal Services receives 2 calls a day regarding dogs left inside vehicles. That's 2 calls a day we'd rather not have to respond to, but we're always going to make sure the animals are safe inside the cars.
Good girl.
All of our animal control officers are equipped with a window punch. If your animal's in the car and it's in distress, this is what they're going to use to break the window to get into your car. After we break this window, the animal control officer is going to reach into your vehicle, rescue your dog. We're going to transport that dog immediately to a veterinary hospital. So what's that mean for you? First of all, you're going to have expensive veterinary bills at the hospital. Secondly, your vehicle is sitting in a parking lot with a broken window, and we're not there to babysit it. The moral of the story is, leave your dog at home. Don't take him for these short rides. Don't put your dog's life at risk during the summer months.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.